I'm glad Professor Jordan told me what this meant. I talking about the same thing, and now I understand it. In my remarks, I mean by the old rhetoric a vague grandiloquence, the kind of speech Claude Pepper, Huey Long, and Everett Dirksen loved to deliver. Weaver can't provide all the answers to the question of why 19th century Americans were moved by this language. To do so would be to explain a whole host of related questions. For example, why 19th century readers loved novels overloaded with inert description, like the works of Walter Scott, and we admire the tightly controlled narratives of Flaubert and James Joyce. Or why so much of 19th century theater seems like mere recitation, rather than the firing of the gun on Hedda Gabler's wall. Early in the essay, Weaver acknowledges that the problem can be explained in part by the loss of a national consensus. Quote, "It's now a truism that the homogeneity of belief, which obtained three generations ago, has largely disappeared. Such belief was, in a manner of conceiving it, the old orator's capital." I'd like to elaborate on that statement in an effort to add a small measure of understanding to Weaver's ambitious essay, which ultimately touches on the destiny of America. I would suggest that the old rhetoric was characterized by three traits, in addition to those already discussed. It tended to address a much smaller audience than is at first apparent. Second, that this audience, after recognizing the style and tone of the speech, would accept virtually anything the speaker said as truth. And third, that it melded the religious and secular orders to lend the authority of the former to the latter. Among other things, the old rhetoric was rooted in the unquestioned assumption that virtue was a thing as palpable and knowable as Newton's apple, that it existed not only in individuals but in peoples as well, and in nations. Speech after 19th century speech affirmed that America's spectacular rise was God's reward for its exceptional goodness. Thus patriotic orators dignified and exalted the subject through the language of Scripture. Allusions to biblical narrative, references to God, our Lord, the Almighty, Providence, or, in George Washington's quaint phrase, the benign parent of the human race. Clearly, he didn't believe in the Big Bang theory. Most who delivered these speeches, I think, believed unquestioningly that such rhetoric didn't merely adorn the subject like colored bulbs on a Christmas tree, but probed its essential nature and defined its position in the created order. Such usage inevitably invested political discourse with religious overtones, the aura of prophecy authenticated by the blessing of God. Small wonder. The most important literary influence on American political oratory from the 17th century well into the 20th century was surely the King James Bible, translation of which began in 1607 and was completed in 1611. The English language available to the translators of this Bible was perhaps the richest and most versatile in linguistic history. For one thing, English had more words than other languages. Because more than 500 years earlier, the Norman conquest had brought with it the French language, which, with its polysyllabic Latin diction, became the polite and proper alternative to a blunt, often monosyllabic Anglo-Saxon. By the early 17th century, the two languages had become one. Tough and earthy, grand and eloquent. No other language had quite the same capacity for Weaver's spaciousness, as did 17th century English, and no language was more familiar to 19th century Americans. Most of them heard it in church on Sunday, both read and quoted from the pulpit, where sometimes sermons ran as long as 3 hours, what with no NFL games starting at 12 noon, and no shiny mall to shop. People read their Bibles during the week and went to Wednesday night prayer meeting, and when a traveling preacher set up his tent just outside town, went to hear him preach the gospel night after night. I read somewhere that the gay 90s song, "There'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight," originally referred not to an orgy, as I'd always thought, but to the advent of an itinerant preacher. In discussing the spaciousness of the old rhetoric, Weaver chose obscure examples, which have already been discussed, perhaps so he could discuss the phenomenon without reference to political controversy that might spill over into the 21st century. To make a couple of slightly different points, I would like to examine speeches by Daniel Webster, Abraham Lincoln, and Jefferson Davis. One of Webster's greatest speeches was delivered at Plymouth Rock on December 22, 1820, in the kind of nasty New England weather that they seem to thrive on up there. As Webster said, it was at this time of year that the pilgrims landed at that very spot, which he proceeded to consecrate with his rhetoric. Quote, "There is a local feeling connected with this occasion too strong to be resisted, a sort of genius of the place which inspires and awes us. We feel that we are on the spot where the first scene of our history was laid, where the hearths and altars of New England were the first places, where Christianity and civilization and letters made their first lodgment in a vast extent of country covered with a wilderness and peopled by roving barbarians. We are here at the season of the year at which the event took place. The imagination irresistibly and rapidly draws around us the principal features and the leading characters in the original scene. We cast our eyes abroad on the ocean, and we see where the little bark, with the interesting group upon its deck, made its slow progress to the shore." Goes on and on. Note his commitment to the single place and its unique people. This is a speech for New Englanders, not for the rest of the nation, not for Andrew Jackson, not for Daniel Boone, not even for the dandies of New York City saluting each other with their gold-headed canes as they strode down Fifth Avenue. Knowing that only New Englanders would come out on a day like this, he was free to expand on the myth that had already become a part of the region's heritage. Here I use the word myth, not to mean a lie, but a commonly held belief of a people that helps them define themselves to themselves. Listening to Webster, we almost forget that the pilgrims who arrived in 1620 were not the first Europeans to land on these shores, not the first to introduce Christianity, not even the first to celebrate Thanksgiving. In fact, the pilgrims were seeking to join the already established colony at Jamestown, founded in 1607, and were blown off their course. But who cares about dates when you're shivering on a gray beach trying to light the fires of ancient piety in sub-zero weather? Webster's version has much in common with the other creation myths of tribes and nations around the world, which teach a specific community that they are the first people. Obviously, Webster's myth has been exported to the entire nation. A majority now believe that the Plymouth Pilgrims were the very first European settlers to land on these shores, and that they invented Thanksgiving. Poor old Jamestown. Occasionally, someone down here lodges a complaint. A while back, a an unreconstructed South Carolinian said, "I don't want my children taught that their country was brought up by a boatload of lost Yankees." No one understood the proper and effective use of the old language better than Abraham Lincoln, who could engage in the raw-boned give-and-take of partisan debate staged for the boys at Springfield, and then craft and deliver the Gettysburg Address, a splendid example of 19th-century rhetoric, though more compact than most. First, let's look at the two discussions of the five words in the Declaration of Independence Lincoln most admired. All men are created equal. In an 1857 speech on the Dred Scott decision, he challenges Stephen Douglas's contention that the phrase meant all peoples are created equal. That is, the American people en masse were equal to the British people. An interpretation that seems even less convincing today than it did to Lincoln, who efficiently unmasked its absurdity. Note the lack of any spacious rhetoric in this. I think the authors of that notable instrument intended to include all men, but they did not intend to declare all men equal in all respects. They did not mean to say all were equal in color, size, intellect, moral development, or social capacity. They defined with tolerable distinctness in what respects they did consider all men created equal. In certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This they said, and this they meant. At the dedication of the Gettysburg battlefield, however, the place, the occasion, and the audience demanded a different kind of rhetoric, one that lifted the hearts of those present, some of whom had lost husbands, sons, fathers, at this very battle, a rhetoric that dignified the heroic dead and placed their sacrifice in the context of a larger, more enduring truth. He did not, as Julia Ward Howe did, say that it was the army of the Lord. He began with an opening phrase, 47 years ago, not the kind of language you would use in conversation at the dinner table. These first words were a signal to his audience. What follows will be a language more to be savored and then pondered over, an appeal to heart rather than head. As the speech develops, it becomes the liturgy of a secular communion, one that Lincoln and his audience share with each other and with the dead. Of this speech, Weaver wrote, "At Gettysburg, Lincoln spoke in terms so generic that it's almost impossible to show that the speech is not a eulogy of the men in the gray as the men in blue, inasmuch as both made up those who struggled here." You know, I can't buy that. I'm going to skip the discussion of it. But to say that that Lincoln concludes by saying that this war settled the question of whether or not we would continue to have government of the people, by the people, and for the people, the Confederacy certainly didn't want to abolish that form of government. There could have been an argument there on both sides. But in this group, at this particular time, no argument. Jefferson Davis, had he been standing on the fringe of that sun-drenched crowd, might have pursed his lips and looked around and raised eyebrows. I'm sure he would have not broken the decorum of the occasion by shouting out, "You lie!" But he could have engaged in serious debate on the proposition. All right, Jefferson Davis, in his inaugural address, talks about the Declaration of Independence as well, and he uses it as a reason for secession, using the the American Revolution as his example. I want to close by showing you what happened to the old rhetoric. It degenerated into bathos and pomposity. And I found the best example. This is one of my favorite passages in all of American literature. Governor Bob Taylor used to speak around the country using this old rhetoric when it was long since out of style. And he was governor at the time that Tennessee had its centennial celebration. And so he had to greet a whole bunch of people, one of whom were the traveling salesmen called drummers. And so he gives this, he welcomes them with this statement. If I were a sculptor, I would chisel from the marble my ideal of a man. I would make it the figure of a drummer with his grip. If I were a painter, I would paint a picture of Jacob's ladder, and upon its rungs, I would paint the angelic form of a drummer, ascending and descending with the best line of harps on the market to sell to the inhabitants of the celestial world. God bless the drummers. They are the personification of Christian endeavor, and all they need is pink tights and gauze wings to make them equal to the cherubim and seraphim. Who can imagine a vision more sublime than innumerable drummers flying through the air with their grip sacks in their hands, diving and snorting among the clouds like porpoises in mid-ocean? At the end, he bursts into song. I know the tune, but I'm not going to sing it. If this kind of rhetoric, with its florid goodness, had long ago disappeared from the public arena, we still have speeches that use the same extravagant language, infused by the same vague emotional fervor, and even invoke the Almighty, speeches that offer a darker vision of America. I have several examples. I'll read just one. The government gives them drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America. No, 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 God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing people. God damn America for treating our citizens as less than human. God damn America for as long as she acts like she is God and she is supreme. How did we evolve from the land of Webster and Lincoln to the land of Jeremiah Wright? More to the point, what can we do about it in the digital age? I'm not sure that sea changes of this magnitude are subject to conscious correction. It takes millions and millions of slovenly people to let a great nation fall into careless disregard of its own spiritual well-being. The virtue of America is not something you can address independently of all its 300 million people. It's a question Persia, Athens, and Rome must have asked themselves, and history. And the reply for them came back cold and merciless. Whatever your virtues may have been, they were only human virtues, and therefore, you always lived in the shadow of God's closing hand.